You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
We see them on the news, military dogs, helping to protect the lives of military and civilian personnel. Their duties range from detecting explosives and drugs used on patrols to other specialized functions for the Department of Defense and other government agencies. But who takes care of them when they get injured? What type of treatments are available to them? And when they can no longer actively serve their country, do they get military retirement benefits? Besides dogs, the Army also uses other animals in the protection of the United States. Today we'll be talking to Colonels Robert Vogelsang and Dr. David Rolfe, both veterinarians and both colonels in the U.S. Army. They'll brief us on what the military is doing to select, train, and protect our four-legged soldiers, as well as other animals that are involved in the protection of our United States. We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Hey, ready to take a walk? Not just you, but the whole family. It's the 2009 Whisker Walk, Sunday, June 7th from 11 to 3 at the Lancaster Fairground in Lancaster, Massachusetts. Pet owners and animal lovers walk to lend a paw to benefit the animal shelters and pet charities they love. Come see exhibits, demonstrations, educational programs, special attractions, product giveaways, entertainment, auctions, raffles, food, fun, and things for adults and kids to see, do, and buy, both human and pet-related. Whisker Walk 2009, a fun day for everyone. For more information, log on to whiskerwalk.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, Pet Life Radio proudly presents DSPN, the Dog Sports and Performance Network. Get ready to unleash the dog sports enthusiast in all of us. From speed drawing and mushing to racing, agility, and competition, this is the place to learn all about the dog sports and activities that you can do with your furry best friend and canine competitor. So get ready for game time. DSPN with your host, Lori Williams, every week on demand. Only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Doctors Vogelsang and Rolfe, thank you so much for being with us today. This is an area that many people have no idea of what is happening, and I think you can really give us a good overview. I appreciate you being with us today.
Well, you're quite welcome.
First, Doctor, is it better to say Colonel Dr. Rolfe or...
Six, one half dozen another. Depends who your audience is. I suppose we're, because you're talking to the military, who you're asking about the military, Colonel might be better.
So, Colonel David, I know that you are in charge, if that is correct, of VETCOM. What is VETCOM?
If I could take a step back real quick, the U.S. Army Veterinary Corps that you brought up a couple of times, it helps for folks to understand that that is the licensed DVMs for the Department of Defense, specifically the Army, but as you may realize, most of the DVMs in the military are within the Army. We also then have an enlisted corps that comprises food inspection specialists and animal technicians, you know, the nurses and the folks that are inspecting the food for the Department of Defense. And that, along with the veterinary corps and our warrant officers, is the veterinary service. U.S. Army Veterinary Command, which I'm commander of, is the largest subset of the veterinary corps and the veterinary service. And we provide animal medical care, public health, food protection support to every installation in the Department of Defense throughout the world, except specifically in the OIF-OEF theaters, so Iraq and Afghanistan.
So this group, it is not just dogs that you take care of. I was listening to the inauguration and understand that they have some of their ceremonial horses, and all of a sudden one of the horses got spooked, injured itself, and there were veterinarians already there on scene. How did that happen?
Like you said, we take care of the working dogs, but the caisson horses, the ceremonial horses, like at the inauguration, we have ceremonial horses at many installations to kind of capture our heritage, the military's heritage, with cavalry and that sort of thing. The Navy has some interesting animals that they use, dolphins and sea lions. Despite the fact dogs swim, they don't do such a good job in the deep water, but the Navy uses dolphins and sea lions to help identify and protect the ship, but also find things on the bottom of the ocean that the Navy may have dropped. So they have practice torpedoes or practice missiles, then those marine mammals can go find those for them, use their superior senses, and save the government money by reclaiming those things and using them again.
And it is the Army Veterinary Corps that takes care of the Navy animals?
Yes, it is. The Navy does not have veterinarians in their organization. We're responsible for that. It's called the executive agent responsibility, but we do it for all the services.
What are some of the exciting things? I think most people would go, wow, you know, dolphins and seals, that would be really exciting. As these animals are transported throughout the world, are veterinarians involved in that transport?
Quite. I mean, when they take the dolphins from their location here stateside, they put them on planes and big waiting pools, I guess a way to put it, on some of our cargo planes. And we always have a veterinarian and several technicians, or at least one vet and several techs, on that aircraft with the animal.
There are some people who might be interested in, for instance, becoming a veterinarian, but going, wow, it's really pretty expensive. And this is somewhat away from where we were initially going. But does the Army, for instance, help out if, for instance, you say, okay, I want to become a veterinarian. Can I join the Army? And will they help pay for something like this?
You aren't getting paid by a recruiting command, are you?
No, I'm not.
No, I'm glad you asked. The Army has a couple of ways to help out with the cost of veterinary school. They have a health profession scholarship program, HPSP, where we pay between 2 and 4 years worth of their veterinary school education. We also have had in years past, and probably will continue in the future, a loan repayment program. So folks that have already gotten their veterinary license or veterinary degree and are licensed, they can apply to come into the military and get some loan repayment help.
So you could join the Army, become a veterinarian, take care of dolphins, work on research animals. Correct me if I'm wrong, aren't some of the U.S. Army veterinarians also involved with organizations like the CDC?
Yes, they are. You know, since you mentioned the research animals, I'll kind of finish up, if you don't mind, on
Please.
The other types that we take care of. We do have laboratory animal vets that are involved in supporting research efforts for the Department of Defense, and a lot of times interacting with other federal agencies. We take care of unit mascots. I don't know if you've seen the Falcons for the Air Force Academy or the Army Mule for the service schools, but also individual units, both downrange and here back in safety, I guess, derive a lot of pleasure, a lot of benefit from having a mascot. We'll take care of those animals for the units. We take care of human-animal bond dogs, you know, the dogs that visit both service members and their families in hospitals. And then we do take care of service members, both active and retirees, and their families' pets. And so in addition to possibly more visible things like the working dogs, we are pretty active in taking care of lots of pets.
Dr. Dave, you'd also mentioned that the Veterinary Corps was involved in food safety. I think a lot of people would be very surprised at that, thinking food safety, you probably just have some public health official, somebody who's gone to school and learned about food safety. Why are veterinarians involved in this, and why not somebody like an MD, for instance?
Good question, and some of that is history. Way back in the Continental Army, when we took our food supply with us, or maybe drove our food supply with us, or got it off the local farms, the vets were involved at that point with the antemortem inspection of the food, making sure that cow was healthy before we used it for food. And we have maintained that responsibility over the years. We now have folks that are specially trained in most every area of the food supply, from dairy to poultry to beef to fresh fruits and vegetables. A lot of that is done by our enlisted corps, but the real science-heavy aspect of maintaining a safe food supply is done by the veterinarians. I suppose today's global war on terrorism, with the potential threat for intentional contamination of the food, that's added quite the new dimension to the job. And we've had to adapt and look at our food supply differently, along with the rest of the nation and our federal partners, to ensure the nation's food supply is safe.
I know, I think a lot of people would be surprised that about 70%, if I remember correctly, of the new emerging bioterrorist agents that can be used are actually zoonotic diseases, those diseases that can affect humans as well as animals. And veterinarians really are on the forefront to first see these. A story I love telling people is, most people might remember the movie called Outbreak several years ago with Dustin Hoffman. And it was based on a true story. The book is called Hot Zone, and it was a female veterinarian in the Army working for the CDC who discovered that it was Ebola virus that had gotten into the United States, and she was the one who identified it. So it's like, yes, it was the Army, and oh yes, it was a female veterinarian. The Army also is doing some marvelous work on positive public relations, because as you are in these various theaters throughout the world, that you are also helping the local people with their livestock and their raising of animals. Isn't that correct?
Correct. And we do a lot of stability operations type things in these developing countries and try to, I suppose, make them our friends before somebody else makes them our enemies. But we go into Africa, South America, throughout the Pacific Rim on a regular basis and do the civic action, humanitarian assistance type exercises, usually with the local military, so that country's military, but go in and help them either devise rabies prevention programs like in the Philippines, or to, as you said, help the local folks learn how to better care for their animals. And of course, so many of those countries are so dependent on the agricultural infrastructure for survival.
One of the main reasons why I wanted to chat with both of you colonels today was because of the information that I had learned about Lackland Air Force Base and their new veterinary facilities that they have there. So many of us will see on the news these dogs in Iraq, Iran, here in the United States, being used for determining if there's explosives before a human gets hurt. And, of course, you never want a dog or an animal to be ever injured. But when they are injured, what is done? What happens out in the field? How are they stabilized?
You want to take this one, Bob? Or?
Well, sure, I can do that, I guess. The dogs are cared for just like their human counterparts. So if they're injured in Iraq or Afghanistan, they're going to be attended to first by the handler. The handler is the immediate responder. stops the bleeding, gets them evacuated to the first veterinary care capability. Their resuscitative care is performed in that particular location, and if they survive their wounds and need more definitive care, they would be evacuated, usually in these theaters, to Europe, where we have a facility in the Kaiserslautern, Germany area. And then once the animal is seen there, if they need further rehabilitative care, for instance, then they may come to my facility here in San Antonio. But no, their care is very similar to that of their human counterparts. They are medically regulated through the healthcare system, just like a person would be.
So the medics that would be on the front line taking care of humans and the dogs at the same time?
Yeah, it tends to be where a lot of the infantry or other units that engage in combat or hostilities will tend to have a medic with them. Well, the units that have dogs don't usually have a veterinary technician with them. So part of my job here at the Department of Defense Military Working Dog Veterinary Service, as well as Colonel Roth's job for his veterinarians out at duty sites, is to train the handlers in first aid and working dog care, because again, since there's not a veterinary technician with these units when they're out on patrol, for instance, if a dog gets wounded, it's going to be the handler that's the first responder. And if the handler gets hurt, it probably would be the human medic, if you will. That would apply the same principles to the dog's injuries. And then they would again evacuate the dog up to the first veterinary facility available.
We're talking right now with Dr. Robert Vogelsang and Dr. David Rolfe. Both are colonels in the U.S. Army, telling us about how the U.S. Army takes care of not just dogs, but other animals involved in all areas of the military and in our United States defense. We'll be right back after this short break and learning how are these dogs actually chosen and what goes into their training. We'll be right back after the short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Greetings, human. What planet am I on?
Welcome to Pet Planet. Here's a copy of Pet Planet magazine, Florida's most informative and fun pet resource magazine. It features heartwarming stories and informative articles from local and national pet experts.
Excellent.
Pet Planet magazine offers Operation Planet Rescue, helping rescued pets find new homes. And it's available at 500 locations in South and Central Florida and 24/7 on the internet at petplanetmagazine.com. If you're out and about with your pet, you may be featured in Paparazzi, candid pictures of you and your pet. For up-to-date pet-friendly events, activities, and pet-related services and products, Pet Planet Magazine is your final destination.
I shall take this magazine home with me.
Back to your home planet?
No, to my condo in Boca.
Pet Planet Magazine. Check them out at www.petplanetmagazine.com or 352-394-8578. It's out of this world.
Hi, this is Marcy Davis and my service dog, Whistle, and we're your hosts of Working Like Dogs on Pet Life Radio. Working Like Dogs is the show where you can learn everything you ever wanted to know about working animals or working dogs. Whether you're a member of a working dog team, or you've just seen a working dog or animal out at the mall or the grocery store, and you're curious about how these amazing animals work with their human partners, then Working Like Dogs is the show for you. Join us for the inside scoop at Working Like Dogs on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Colonels, doctors, thank you very much for being with us today. How many dogs does the military use right now? What are the various breeds that are used?
The military has about 3,200 dogs right now, but it's a growing effort because of how well they perform those duties. Primarily, we've used German Shepherd dogs and Belgian Malinois in the past because of their ability to be aggressive and also their ability to use their senses to help us do what we need them to. With the, I suppose, increase in some of the other areas that you mentioned earlier in the interview, with sniffing for mines and sniffing for improvised explosive devices, we now also use some of the sporting breeds, or like Labradors and pointers and things like that, to augment our force.
What do you look for? Is it the Veterinary Army Corps that does their temperament testing? Are you looking for just that, a dog who's rather pugnacious? What are you looking for in that dog that's going to be drafted into the military?
As far as temperament testing goes, or the ability to train, or the ability to detect or aggress, that is not done by the Veterinary Corps. That is done by dog trainers here that work at Lackland Air Force Base with the Department of Defense Dog Center, or the 341st Training Squadron, which is the Air Force unit that performs that role. So as far as determining the aptitude or the ability or the potential of that dog to be a good working dog, that's done by the Air Force. However, there's a medical screening component to that, and that's what my facility does and my staff does. We go with the Air Force, usually overseas to Europe, to procure these animals, and once they pass the temperament testing or the aptitude testing, they go through a battery of examinations through us. We do a general physical exam, we evaluate elbow films, hip films, lumbar spine films to ensure they don't have elbow dysplasia, hip dysplasia, spondylosis, ununited anconeal processes, anything that might disqualify a dog from active service, just much like would happen to a person who wanted to enter the military service. So that's pretty much how it works. And then once they pass both the aptitude test and the medical screening, then they're brought back to Lackland Air Force Base here at San Antonio to start boot camp, if you will.
Dr. Vogelsang, you said that you go to Europe to find these dogs. I find that interesting, so we're using alien dogs. Why not U.S. bred dogs?
Well, one thing, it's hard to come across as many dogs as we need here in the United States, and the other is cost. A lot of the dogs that come from Europe may have originated in Eastern Europe, where it's a lot less expensive to raise them and care for them. We obviously want to use the taxpayers' money to its best advantage. And actually, a lot of the vendors here in the United States actually procure their dogs from Europe. So many times it's sort of like bypassing a middleman. So mostly it's just because we can't find enough of the dogs that we need here in the U.S., so we end up going to Europe, where there tend to be a lot more vendors and a lot more dogs available.
I know it's not your area of expertise, but if you could explain to us about how long is a training, if we think of the typical dog that's being used on patrol or going out sniffing for explosives, what's their basic boot camp and then their specialized training? What does it involve?
Certainly, just to sort of preface that, we try to produce what we call dual certified dogs, which means they have the ability to detect either drugs or explosives. And certainly in this day and age, it's explosives that most commanders want their dogs to be able to detect. But we also want the dogs to be able to perform what we call patrol duty. So that means aggression. If there's a perpetrator and they're getting away, the handler can then let the dog loose. However, the good thing about a dog is it's sort of like a bullet that can be called back. So it's less than deadly force. So that's the patrol side of the house. So we try to put both of those capabilities into one dog. We try to get the most bang for our buck. And the standard Air Force training period is 120 days. That is what they shoot for, to try to get a dog from the first day of school to graduation, to get them those basic capabilities is 120 days. And certainly some pick up on a little easier and graduate a little thinner, and then there's some that, you know, need a little extra time and special care. But 120 is about the average.
What happens to that dog that maybe just says, and I had a Labrador, for instance, that I tried to schutz and train to become a guard dog as such, and he was great at taking a bite of the towel and these other things and would hold on for dear life, but as soon as there was the person in the suit, the dog said, uh-uh, this is not something I'm going to do. What happens if a dog kind of washes out of boot camp?
Well, certainly, if they're lovers and not fighters, there are other opportunities for those dogs. If they don't need,
is that dishonorable discharge?
Yeah, something like that. First of all, if the dog does not meet Department of Defense standards, we will try to place them with a civilian law enforcement agency or perhaps even another governmental agency. So if a dog does not meet our criteria or is not able to be trained to the place we need them to be, we might offer them to the TSA, for instance, because they're here on the same campus. Or we may offer them to a law enforcement agency. So we do place dogs that were originally intended for Department of Defense into other governmental agencies or to civilian law enforcement. And that's at no charge to the law enforcement municipality. So personnel from those cities or counties, they can come down here to San Antonio, take a look at the dogs. And it may be that that dog, though it may not meet DOD requirements, may meet those for that particular organization. And then off they go with one of our dogs that now be still has a purpose and still has a function, and it's kind of a win-win for everyone. And then we do have some dogs that just don't seem to be able to make that cut either. And if that's the case, if the temperament is right, and usually it is, then the dogs are simply adopted out to a loving family.
That sounds marvelous. To get back to a dog, say, is injured in service and is stabilized either in Europe or wherever it is, and then they realize this is going to need further assistance, it's going to need increased care, then can you tell us a little bit about this new veterinary hospital that's at the Lackland Air Force Base? What is it replacing? When did it open?
Sure, I'd love to tell you about that. Yeah, certainly, if the dogs need rehabilitative care or maybe further specialty care, whether it's surgery or medicine, imaging, they will generally come to my facility here at Lackland. And just to give you an overview, the hospital was opened in October, or officially, the ceremony was conducted in October of 2008, though the building actually started functioning in June of 2008, though it still needed, you know, some of the finishing touches like paint and other things. But it became functional in June of 2008. It replaced a hospital that was built in 1968. So certainly 40 years down the road, you could imagine that the old place really was becoming insufficient for our needs. It certainly was small and cramped. Technologically, it was behind the power curve, as we say in the military. It just wasn't able to allow us to care for the animals the way we wanted to. And we eventually were able to acquire this building, and actually it's an Air Force building. The Air Force funded it. It was approximately $15 million for the construction and the equipping of the facility. However, the TSA actually provided $3 million out of that 15 to purchase things in our diagnostic imaging suite, which includes a 64-slice CT machine, color Doppler echo or sonography, and then also a digital radiography machine. So again, that building that it replaced was 40 years old, and now it's part of a beautiful parking lot extension. But not a whole lot of people were too sad to see it go, just because it had served its purpose and we needed something new.
This sounds like it's a real Walter Reed of veterinary military hospitals.
Yes, I failed to mention that. Yet, just like with our human counterparts, once they come from usually Europe, they'll go back to one of the larger installations here in the United States, and Walter Reed being one of them. And so I would liken us to a Walter Reed for the veterinary world. We do have the specialty care, we have the equipment, we have the capability to handle pretty much every kind of case. So yes, you're correct. Just to give you a few more factoids, I suppose, the hospital is approximately 38,000 square feet, with about 30,000 of that being directly used for dog care, the other 8,000 for mechanical and admin sort of space. We have 42 staff members. 13 of those are veterinarians. We have 4 admin staff to do records and budget and supply and IT, because you can't do anything without technology or information technology these days. And the rest are technicians. And roughly 1/3 of our staff are civilians and 2/3 are military. And due to the nature of being military, you get reassigned to new locations every 2 or 3 years. So we have to have the civilians to maintain that continuity of care within this facility. So it's a nice working relationship with both military and civilian personnel.
How many dogs can you take care of? Because I can't say how many beds are in this particular hospital. So how many runs and cages do you have?
Yeah, we have 32 runs. We have at least that many portable kennels here that we use for just when dogs have been pre-medicated or they're recovering immediately after surgery or endoscopy or CT, then they're either placed back in their regular kennel, or usually our surgical patients will go into a recovery kennel, one of those 32. However, we care for a population here at Lackland Air Force Base that averages around 750 to 800 dogs at any one time. So there's always that many dogs here right at Lackland Air Force Base. So we have we keep quite busy taking care of just those 800. Each dog, whether it's here at Lackland or in Colonel Roth's command, have two physical exams each year. One of them includes full CBC, Chem, UA, FECO exam. Some dogs, depending on age, will get ECG, other imaging studies. We'll get dental prophylaxis as needed, usually once every year. We do that here for all 800 of our folks, even though it's a rotating population as those, some graduate and new ones come in. We also take care of referred dogs. So those dogs that are out in Colonel Ross' command, if the facility where they're located does not have the capability, equipment, facilities, or expertise, then they will refer the dog to our hospital here at Lackland, and then we'll perform the diagnostics, do the surgery, or what other care, and then we will ship the dog back to their home station.
Is this Lackland Veterinary Hospital the only such hospital in the United States, or are there other facilities similar to yours? Maybe not as marvelous as yours, but similar to yours.
Well, Colonel Roth, I'm going to let you go ahead and tackle that one.
Gotcha. There's none that are anything like the one at Lackland, but we have some smaller ones in Europe that is that initial care facility when they get evacuated out of the theater of operations, Iraq, Afghanistan. We have one in Okinawa and one in Korea that take care of that side of the world. We have a smaller referral center on the West Coast and a smaller one on the East Coast, but nothing like the 38,000 square feet he's got.
Sounds fantastic. Dr. Vogelsang, since it seems to be under your purview, what are some of maybe just one of those fantastic stories that you have? A dog came in, needed care, and it was definitely state-of-the-art, cutting-edge, and with a good outcome.
Well, let's see. We did have one dog, Buko. He was in Afghanistan. Now, he wasn't wounded. He did not receive, combat injuries, but he became acutely paralyzed in the rear end, and he couldn't move, and he was originally stationed in Germany. So they sent him back to Germany, and the veterinarian there found that he did have some motor in his hind limbs. They did some diagnostics and found that it wasn't a TL disc. They weren't sure what to do, called us up. We thought maybe he had a fibrocartilaginous embolism. However, the only way to see if he could come back would have long-term rehab, which really is not available anywhere else. No one else has the space, the facilities, the expertise. So Buko was sent here, and when I saw him, I was not particularly thinking
hopeful.
That he would lay. Yeah, I was not particularly hopeful. He really couldn't move his hind end at all. Really wasn't sure how much better he could get, but we went ahead and started him in rehab. So he started out in his little wheelchair kind of device, like you see with the dachshunds who had TL myelopathy, and we have a certified canine rehabilitation practitioner, and she has access to, I will say, most of the toys. So we have shockwave, therapeutic ultrasound, cold laser, we have dry treadmill, we have wet treadmill.
The wet treadmill being the underwater treadmill, the underwater, so the dog's the actually
sometimes,
in
yeah,
the pool
you,
water.
Yeah, you don't want to say that because people go, well, how does he breathe underwater? And, you know, so we
doggy periscope.
Yeah. So anyway, with time, with massage therapy, with range of motion exercises, actually Buko started getting better, and we got more movement and more muscle mass back on him. And 4 months later, Buko is actually fairly ambulatory. Now he looks, he's still ataxic. And I'm not so sure if he will ever go back to being a working dog, but we got a dog that really did not have much hope back to where he can urinate and defecate on his own. He can get up and walk around, and he'll probably end up being adopted, but to me that was not an option that we had back when I was here 10 years ago as a major, when A, we didn't have the facilities, and B, the legislation was not in place where we could adopt an animal. So even though in this case, Buko isn't going back to his unit to be a working dog, certainly he came a long way based on the capabilities and the personnel and facilities that we had here. So, but we do, just to give you an idea of the capabilities, again, I mentioned our diagnostic imaging capabilities. We also have full endoscopic capability with every diameter and length of fiber optic endoscope with the newest equipment, so we can really probe any orifice and see what's going on. We have, in our surgery suite, we have two large operatories. Both have laparoscopic, arthroscopic towers, so we try to use those modalities anytime we can. All the females are spayed prior to training. Obviously, if they go into heat, then that causes a little chaos out in the training field, or certainly would also cause chaos if they
distraction.
Were in a rack and attracting feral animals. And we do most of those laparoscopically. And then we also, while we're in there, we'll perform a laparoscopically assisted gastropexy. We try to do prophylactic gastropexies on all the dogs that we can. Certainly all the females get that before they go to operational units, and we try to do as many of the males as we can here.
What is gastropexy?
Oh, sorry about that. Certainly in the German Shepherd breed and even in the Malinois, we see a condition called gastric dilatation involvulus, or also known as bloat, where the stomach becomes distended with gas and fluid and will twist upon itself. And in doing so, it sort of kinks off the blood supply to the stomach, and also that pressure on the vena cava, or the large vessel that brings blood back from the back half of the body to the heart, that big distended stomach presses against that vena cava and prevents blood from getting back to the heart, so they get shocky. So the dogs can become very, very sick. And
very, some die.
Yes.
Yes.
And they can die, and it can be a very quick thing. The dog can look totally normal 1 minute, and maybe an hour or so later could be dead. And because this does happen in this breed with some regularity, we feel it's just better to prophylactically tack the stomach to the body wall to prevent the stomach from being able to twist. Now, it might still distend with gas and fluid, but the dog could at least burp or throw up, or the gas and fluid could go the other way, but at least it won't rotate on itself and cause the problems that could kill the animal. So this is a preventable condition that we try to take care of here. And as I was alluding to, the dogs that are not prophylactically pexied here at Lackland go out into the field, and then the veterinarians under Colonel Ross' command perform those procedures at the dog's home station. So certainly we've seen a great decrease in the incidence of gastric dilatation volvulus in the military population. Now, it's not because ours aren't getting it. It's just they've been prophylactically cared for.
So very good preventative care. You know, the twice-a-year examinations is wonderful. And it's things we're always trying to have the pet owner realize, that for their own pets, getting in at least twice a year for a good wellness exam, you know, building up that team relationship. Here, all your handlers know their animals so well. When these animals are no longer able to continue on with their active duties, are they retired? Do they get retirement benefits?
Not really. Certainly nothing of a corollary to their human counterparts. However, there was legislation passed, which is kind of affectionately known as the Robbie Law, which Robbie was the name of the dog for which the legislation was named. And he was the dog at the center of it. Prior to that legislation being passed, dogs were not allowed to be adopted to the public, and it was very unfortunate that once a dog reached the end of its service life, that euthanasia ended up being the fate of most of these animals. And after the legislation was passed, it allowed these dogs that were at the end of their service life, because perhaps, well, it's just having an 11-year-old dog trying to do a young dog's job. It's just like having maybe a 70-year-old man trying to do a 30-year-old man's job. So it certainly was very nice that we were able to have these older animals who still had some spunk left in them, just couldn't do the military service, be able to be adopted by a loving family and live out their last remaining years in what we call Fort Living Room, so to speak. And so most of the dogs that reach the end of their service life, whether it's just because they're kind of older, or some dogs also have other medical conditions that maybe preclude them from being deployable at a younger age, like gracilis contracture, semitendinosus contracture, something like that, which, okay, they're otherwise healthy, but they really cannot perform the function of a military working dog. So they will end up being offered up for adoption to families. And so that generally is the fate of most dogs that reach the end of their career. I can't say every dog is adopted. The dogs are assessed for their temperament and aggression, and unfortunately there are some dogs, but very, very few, that are so aggressive that it would be dangerous to place them in with a family. And for those dogs, if they can no longer work, and if we can't adopt them, then they may end up being euthanized as well. But that is a very, very, very small number of dogs. So generally, it's a happy story where we can take a dog that is faithfully served, and by the way, are the only draftees left in the Department of Defense. And once they've completed their service, then it is nice that most of them go on to live their sunset years with someone who loves them and will take care of them. And
in Fort Front Room. I love it.
Living room, yeah.
Colonels Vogelsang and Rolf, thank you very much for being with us today. This is some fascinating information that I never knew about. Knowing all the various animals that are involved in the U.S. military and all the various arenas in which veterinarians are involved in the military really, I think, was an eye-opener. Thank you both very much. We do appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome.
It's always our goal of this show to educate and to entertain. I think today this was very definitely educated. If you have any questions, the first person to always ask is always going to be your own veterinarian. If there's other questions you just need to have maybe a second opinion, please feel free to email me at thepetdoctor@petliferadio.com. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. I hope you have a marvelous week. Please tune in again next week when we'll have more fascinating information. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.